in the nuclear race. That way they could look clean but act dirty. Years ago, all the way back in 2009, everybody, U.S. intelligence, the Brits, the International Atomic Energy Agency, all had evidence that Iran was experimenting with uranium deuteride, used as a neutron source for the trigger system for nukes. But now, one of our contacts in Kyrgyzstan tells us he's seen documents passed between the Russian nuclear scientists and the North Koreans, and between the Russians and the Iranians. These papers show plans for the manufacture of very small neutron initiator systems, so small that the entire nuclear weapon could fit into the size of, say, a funeral coffin or the bed of a small pickup truck. We've also been told something else, and this is critical, that there was some kind of transportation timetable. Joshua zeroed in on that. You're talking transportation of a weapon? No, weapons, plural. Two of them. The next question was the most important one, and everyone in the room knew it. Gallagher leaned forward, his hands flat on the conference table as if he was going to vault off a gymnastic side horse at the Olympics. Joshua asked, "What's the timetable?" The man on the screen leaned back in his chair and delivered the bad news. The clock's already ticking. Chapter 18. There was no tidy ending to the roundtable meeting. It was the only time that Joshua had failed to forge some kind of consensus before adjourning. Pac McHenry, behind his scrambled image on the screen, ended the session by indicating that his volunteer agents would be at the disposal of the roundtable, but if no coordination could be forged with Joshua's group, he said his people would be forced to go it alone. The only problem, the Patriot explained, is that we lack the resources and political clout of your group. I'm not sure my group of former intel operatives acting alone could stop this thing. What do you want from us? Senator Leander blurted out. You're telling us our nation's going to be blown up with nuclear weapons and that the government isn't heeding your warnings. So tell us straight. What do you want us to do? McHenry didn't hesitate. We need you to take the lead. You've got a retired four-star general and a former FBI terrorism expert right there in the room with you. Your group is led by an Air Force flying ace who has given the Pentagon the cleverest anti-missile device in military history. You've got a former U.S. senator and a retired federal judge. We need you to coordinate this, make the judgment calls, forge the plan, and we'll give you all the assistance we can. Having turned the responsibility over to the roundtable, the Patriot signed off. Senator Leander, as usual, was cynical. After the video was turned off, he complained, "I think the Patriot wants us to take the rap for this little adventure if his intel turns out to be bad. If we go cowboy on this thing, chasing down and harassing some guys who turn out to be vacuum cleaner salesmen rather than terrorists with a suitcase bomb, who do you think the Department of Justice is going to go after? We'll all end up serving jail time." Phil Rankowitz was astonished. "Alvin, for crying out loud, you know this Patriot group worked with Joshua and Rocky during that Grand Central Station incident. They saved the day. Joshua and his son Cal are both alive because of them. And, of course, because of John Gallagher here sticking his neck out." Gallagher looked away. He didn't handle commendations well. Beverly Rose Cortez, a self-made billionaire, pledged $5 million payable immediately as a down payment to stop these bloodthirsty terrorists. But as soon as she said that, she hedged, "But only if you can tell me exactly who the people are, the ones in this nuclear plot. Can anyone tell me that?" As usual, Judge Fort Rice had hung back, weighing things. When Joshua asked for his opinion, Rice just shook his head. "I keep going back to what the Patriot said. I jotted it down. He has no assurances that the government had followed up on these leads. For me, that's too vague. I need more. How can he be sure? This is where we have to decide who we trust and who we believe. I can't accept the notion that the CIA and the FBI would just disregard a threat like this, if in fact it's a credible one. And that's a big if." Rankowitz wanted Abigail's take on the judge's comment. She tried to be diplomatic. "I respect your analytical approach, Judge. your desire for some kind of legal certainty, but I'm not sure that's the right approach. If this really is an imminent threat, we have to make judgments on the facts as they are presented, not as we wish they were. The judge wouldn't shift. Burden of proof. That's the legal standard we ought to use, Abby. For me, legal analysis is all we have to rely on. Bottom line is that he didn't meet my burden of proof. It was his job to convince me of the facts, and he didn't. Gallagher tried to choose his words carefully. Judge, remember one thing. This is not the same CIA and FBI that I joined years ago. A lot of it has to do with all the political ropes and chains that have been looped around everything they do now. They're men and women, brave ones too, working in unbelievably dangerous situations. But now they have to do it in a crazy political and legal straitjacket. The people at the top are the ones responsible for that. Plus, you heard what the Patriots said about the dangerous downside of this new consolidation of the security agencies at the top. Fewer people make the decisions. I agree 100%. Joshua suggested that they carry the meeting over to a second day, but people had other commitments. Instead, they would link up by encrypted conference call in 72 hours. Joshua and Gallagher resisted the delay, but the rest wouldn't budge. Joshua got the feeling that as much as the group wanted to believe the threat was both real and imminent, they had too many lingering doubts, and that clouded everything. That night, as Joshua and Abigail sat alone on the back porch outside their bedroom suite, looking at the stars, he expressed his own doubts. Maybe I should have pushed harder. That isn't your job. No, of course not. You chair the round table. You lead the discussion. But these are accomplished men and women. They're not junior staffers you can order around. They have to make up their own minds. Listen to us. Talking as if this was some bad policy in Washington that we want changed. This is a nuclear strike against our nation. I was there, dear, remember? Well, it surprises me you aren't as agitated as I am. Hours are ticking by. Men coming after our cities with weapons of mass destruction, and what are we doing? Wasting 3 days till we meet again by phone. What would you suggest? Something. Anything. 72 hours is an eternity when national security's on the line. What then? I'm calling Pat McHenry, putting together a tighter plan. Then when we have our conference call, I'll lay it all out. An up or down vote. A plan in 3 days to stop a nuclear attack? You don't even know the target or how the nukes will come into the country. Josh, how are you going to do that? He had no idea, but he wasn't going to admit it. They fell silent. He looked up and recognized one of the constellations. Up in the black void of the sky were the cold, twinkling lights of Orion. Suddenly he felt tired, but his mind kept clicking and churning. He changed the subject. I want to talk to Cal tomorrow. He wanted to see you today, but the minute you got back from New York, you buried yourself in your study, then into the round table. Why does that sound a little like an indictment? No, just a wifely observation. Talk to him, Josh. I will. In fact, I told him as soon as I was done with the round table we'd get together. He seemed okay with that. The phone rang. Joshua got up and trotted into the bedroom to catch it. Abigail could hear his voice growing more animated as he talked. After he hung up, he came back out to the porch, but he had a startled look on his face. Abby, guess who that was? Patsy, from the office. The Jordan Technologies, Patsy, the new receptionist? Yes. A little late, isn't it? Joshua flopped back down on the chair next to Abigail. A smile was spreading on his face. You know how you asked me a minute ago how I could pull all this together? A plan to stop this horrendous thing from happening? He answered his own question. I just got an idea. Chapter 19. There were catcalls and shouts from the curb in downtown Manhattan, and they threatened to drown out the proceedings. A handful of reporters and a dozen onlookers had gathered in a semicircle around the front steps of the Eternity Church for a press conference, but the noise across the street forced everyone to strain to hear what the pastor was saying as he stood outside the old brown brick cathedral. Several NYPD cops kept the small mob of protesters from getting out of hand. Most of them had wandered down from an unrelated demonstration on Wall Street a few blocks away. With the unemployment rate at 17% and 11 states on the verge of bankruptcy, the public was in full-blown panic. The protesters had hit the streets to blame the robber baron capitalists for the nation's financial woes. But when they heard that a Bible-toting pastor was preaching about the end of America a few blocks away, some of them decided to head over to the church and redirect their fury. A bearded man in a dirty sweatshirt shouted over the press conference from the opposite curb, "Hey, quit bringing God into this, you idiot! It's the capitalist system that's rotten! My kids don't have any food! You can take your Bible and..." A cop grabbed both ends of his nightstick and blocked the man at the chest from walking in the direction of Reverend Paul Campbell, who was standing on the top step in front of the church. Two members of the pastor's Bible prophecy group were standing behind him. A female reporter with a wireless microphone took a step toward Campbell. Her cameraman, who had a quick cam linked to a satellite feed, was right behind her. "What do you say, Reverend Campbell, to that man who can't feed his family? You talk about God's coming judgment, but with our economic problems, do you think people are listening to your message?" Campbell had to raise his voice to be heard. "Our message today isn't just about God's judgment. It's also about God's grace and his plan for redemption. We want people to see the signs of the times and realize that the coming of Jesus Christ is imminent. We can't tell you the day or the hour, but it is very clear as we speak that Jesus is once again approaching the door of human history." "What kinds of signs?" another reporter shouted. "As mentioned by Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, earthquakes. We've seen 14 major earthquakes around the world in the last 12 months, and now the volcanic eruption in Saudi Arabia. Jesus predicted these things would be the birth pangs of the cataclysm to come. The book of Job says that God shakes the earth out of its place, and its pillars tremble. These signs are reminders that the Lord has something he wants to tell us." "And what about our national financial mess?" a man from an internet news service asked. "Are you saying that's from the hand of God?" "I am saying, the Bible is saying, watch for the signs. Jesus also predicted famine. Here in the United States, we haven't pulled out of the dust bowl effects of this drought we are seeing in the Midwest, or from the virus that has been killing off our livestock, or the collapse of many of our financial institutions. The dollar is plunging. We have to get the big picture. Think back to some history. The BP oil disaster along the Gulf Coast. Remember that? Resulting in the halting of offshore drilling. Then promises of renewed drilling. Administrative delays. Another spill. Another shutdown of drilling. Then our government dives into our strategic oil reserves, which become depleted. And when that happened, and when OPEC refused to supply us, where did we turn? To Russia. Why is that important? Because in Ezekiel..." But Campbell was interrupted by a volley of eggs. He was hit in the head and face. The reporters and cameras immediately whirled around to take in the scene across the street, where cops were zip-tying the hands of a few of the egg-throwers. More screaming and scuffling. Pastor Campbell's press conference had disintegrated. A young Asian man in a t-shirt and baggy cargo pants stood on the sidewalk. He had been walking by, but stopped when he heard the pastor's comments. As he walked up the stairs, Campbell was still wiping his face as two of his friends helped him into the church. "Hey!" the Asian man shouted. The other two men held their hands out to block his way, but Campbell turned toward the Asian man.
"So, what do we do?"
the young man asked.
"What now?"
Campbell smiled. "Come inside. Let's talk." In the lobby of the Climate Change Office of the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington, D.C., Dr. Robert Hamilton had been waiting for nearly 2 hours. He was usually a patient man, but his foot was tapping incessantly. His patience had just run out. The papers on his lap were important, more important than his own battle with cancer and the ill effects of the chemo he'd endured. After a long and undistinguished career, Hamilton had stumbled on a discovery so stunning that its magnitude almost defied quantification. He had his hands on a devastating assessment of an impending geological crisis. He ran through his vocabulary: apocalyptic, disastrous, catastrophic, all those words fit. It went far beyond his original thesis, simply that global warming trends had been spiked because of increased volcanic activity. Now the government scientists needed to know it too. In his agitation, Hamilton glanced nervously through the office window to check the weather outside. The sky was darkening. Drat, I didn't bring an umbrella. Finally, a secretary breezed in and motioned to Hamilton.
Dr. Smithson will see you now.
Hamilton grabbed his expandable folder, bulging with papers, and nearly sprinted into the inner office. Smithson was startled by Hamilton's hasty entrance. He stood up and reached over the desk for a handshake.
Bob, good to see you again. It's been a while. What brings you here from the glorious state of Hawaii? Still teaching?
Yes, and doing a lot of field work, which is why we need to talk.
Sure. For a volcanologist like you, there must be plenty to study on the islands.
Well, Henry, lately my field work has been in the Middle East. Smithson cut him off.
Interesting. So, what can I do for you?
Hamilton started to pull papers from his folder. Smithson gave a tight-lipped smile and glanced at his watch.
Henry, this data is startling. Some shocking trends are developing, with potential effects on the global warming debate.
Well, you've come to the right place.
Right. Henry, I needed to show you my computations. I'm aware of the extrapolations your people have made based on spiking global temperatures. I know you are preparing to present them at the International Climate Conference.
Yes. Thank goodness the United Nations pulled together this emergency conclave. You know, Bob, it might be best, rather than take your time to explain this now, just send me an e-data file.
This can't wait. I need your assessment of my conclusions immediately.
I don't think that's going to happen. Hamilton gritted his teeth and tapped his finger on his file.
You don't understand. An environmental cataclysm is coming, and it's going to blow your global warming ideas sky high.
Come on, Bob, leave it alone. Your expertise is in volcanic activity. Leave the climate change stuff to the experts, okay?
Henry, for heaven's sake, you've got to review this data.
Bob, you want the truth? You've been a thorn in our side. Every one of us who has spent our careers on the problem of global warming has had to put up with you. I remember the meeting in Reykjavik, and then in Amsterdam. Frankly, you were an embarrassment. We hold these conferences on climate change trying to salvage this planet, and you keep turning up like a bat penny with your cockamamie theories. Why don't you give it a rest?
No, I can't do that. Will you please look at my findings?
Fine. Send me the e-data file, and when I get the time, I'll look it over. When I get the time. Hamilton could almost feel yet another door hitting him on the backside. He shoved his papers back into the folder.
Henry, you know what's really sad about all this?
What? Smithson was now on his feet and scooting around his desk to escort Hamilton out of his office.
What's tragic is that you're missing the really big catastrophe. The forest for the trees. I can see it coming, but you can't.
What I can see, Smithson said with a grimace, is that I'm late for my next meeting. Take care, Bob. Hamilton played one last card.
I happen to know you have some spaces still open for presenters at the climate conference. I want a speaking slot. Bill me as a dissenting opinion. You owe me that. Let's at least have a debate.
Smithson just stared at Hamilton with a raised eyebrow. He leaned down and punched a button on his phone. He tried to call his secretary, but she had stepped away. So he called Mike Leakey, his research assistant, to bring a parking voucher for his visitor. A moment later, Leakey showed up and handed the coupon to Hamilton and walked him out through the lobby. At the elevator, Hamilton turned to Leakey.
Young man, have you heard about any of my older research papers on the connection between global warming and volcanic activity? I'll send your boss my updated data. Something far more devastating is on the horizon.
There was an awkward silence.
Good luck to you, Professor, Leakey said, but nothing else.
His eyes avoided Hamilton's gaze. His mouth parted like he was about to say something, but no words came out. Instead, Leakey turned and hurried back into his office in the government building. By the time Hamilton made it to the bottom floor, the wind was picking up. A bit of paper swirled into the air. The clouds were black. Hamilton heard a rumbling of thunder as he thought back to his meeting. And then a memory swept in from somewhere.
A line from Shakespeare, Macbeth. When shall we three meet again, in thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done, when the battle's lost and won. For Dr. Robert Hamilton, the outcome was painfully clear. As he prepared to dash to his car, while the thunder rumbled overhead, a thought buzzed in his head like a gnat. Despite his own scientific certainty, Hamilton still couldn't shake that nagging sensation. I'm tired of feeling like the crazy one.
Chapter 20 Deborah Jordan beamed.
Wow! This is awesome. My dad's going to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Joshua had the electronic draft of the letter from the White House in his hand. He turned to his son, Cal, who was standing to one side.
Well, first of all, I'm only one of eight recipients. And second, Cal, you actually deserve the credit for this.
Cal shook his head and stumbled for a response.
No way, Dad. Read the letter.
Joshua handed it to Cal. It mentions my helping in the terrorist incident in Grand Central Station. That was you, right in the middle of it. Or don't you remember?
Cal laughed. Oh, yeah, I remember all right.
Well, your mom and I have to leave today for Washington. I just got the call from my office last night. This thing really came in at the bottom of the ninth. The Rose Garden ceremony is day after tomorrow. For some reason, my office folks didn't see the letter until yesterday. Abigail sauntered over and planted a big kiss on his lips.
Ninth inning or not, you deserve it, darling. They should have given it to you after the Korean incident, but better late than never.
As Abigail, Deborah, and Ethan moved into the big, knotty pine-paneled kitchen for lunch, Cal hung back to talk with his father.
I wanted to talk to you.
Right, absolutely. What's up?
I've been thinking.
When Cal paused, Joshua chimed in. I'm all ears.
Well, here's the deal.
I've dropped my art major. I'm going into poli-sci.
That's quite a change. You sure about this?
Been thinking about it for a while. It sort of crystallized for me up in Boston.
I'm sorry, Cal, that Mom and I couldn't be there. You know the story about our travel problems.
Yeah, no big deal. Mom explained.
Anyway, having your art show in a prestigious gallery, that's a real honor. You clearly have talent.
Thanks.
Why political science?
I guess I realized after the Grand Central Station incident that, well, there are important things I want to be part of. There's bad stuff happening out there. I'd like to make a difference. Be part of the salt and light.
Joshua recognized the reference. He'd heard Abby quote that New Testament phrase more times than he could count. That had always been Abby's thing. It was even Cal's thing, and Deb's as well, but not his. He was the religious holdout, even in the face of the near-miraculous rescue of his son. The stumbling, frantic prayer for help that he had uttered, that was answered. God had been there, he was sure of it. Still, the encounter with Christ that the rest of his family had experienced and talked about, he didn't have that. He'd stopped, right at the one-yard line.
You know what I mean, Dad.
Joshua broke out of his thoughts.
Yeah, I do. Making a difference.
Your mom and I believe in that. You know that.
One more thing.
Sure.
About the roundtable group.
What about it?
Well, you and Mom are in it.
Right.
I'd like to be involved somehow.
What do you know about our group?
Not a lot. Just tidbits. Helping the country, protecting it, defending it. Filling in the gaps where things have fallen apart.
That's a good description.
I think I could help, if I could just get a chance.
Cal, your enthusiasm is great, really. And I'm impressed that you're so interested in what your mom and I do. It's just that the round table, that's not something that you can be part of.
Why not? I'm not talking about wanting to be a big shot, a decision maker. I'd be willing just to be a low-level assistant of some kind.
Look, Cal, I'm serious when I say this. I'm keeping you out of the round table for your own good. We're into some pretty heavy stuff, and if things go wrong, it could be very bad for your mom and me. You know about the controversial things we've been doing. People out there are gunning for us.
That's fine. We're willing to accept that. But I don't want that for you.
Cal gave him a perplexed look. He wasn't going to let it go that easily.
If this country's really in the kind of bad shape we think it is, then why keep me out?
For your protection.
Yeah, and if this was the Revolutionary War and the British were coming up the driveway, then what? You'd toss me a muzzle-loaded rifle and tell me to shoot straight, that's what.
So, just like that, you're talking like a soldier rather than an artist?
Oh, so soldiering is okay for Deb, but not for me, right?
She chose the army life, Cal. You didn't.
Mom's a lawyer, not a soldier, but she's involved. I want to study politics, make a change, just like you and Mom. I think I've earned this. I was the guy at Grand Central Station who almost got blown up by a terrorist.
Cal's face changed a little. He had painfully overplayed his hand and knew it. His father had been right there with him that day, in the thick of it, and his dad had willingly risked death just to save Cal. Joshua clenched his jaw. I'm trying to protect you, Cal. Just like that day in New York. It's too bad you can't see that. You have no idea how dangerous this might get for Mom and me, for all of us in the group. But not for you. You're staying out of it. Understood? The last question hung in the air. It was rhetorical, but had the tone of a military order. His father tried to wrap his arm around him, but Cal stood frozen where he was. His father said, "Let's get some grub. Carletta has fixed some awesome stuff for lunch." After the meal, everyone scattered. Abigail went to the master bedroom to pack. Deborah huddled in a corner of the kitchen laughing with Ethan March. Joshua asked Deborah if he could talk with Ethan alone. Joshua led Ethan into the big living room. Before he could speak, however, Ethan blurted out, "I want to congratulate you, sir, on the Medal of Freedom. You're an amazing man, if I can say that." Joshua gave him a matter-of-fact nod. "Thanks. But frankly, Ethan, I'm a realist. It's an election year. Most likely the White House is giving me the medal as a way to pick up votes. Don't get me wrong, I'm humbled and honored, but I'm cautious, too."
"Cautious?"
Jordan avoided going down that road. "Ethan, are you thinking about staying in defense contracting?"
"Yes, sir. I did well at Raytheon before I got laid off. You've actually been an inspiration for me. Air Force flyer, then into defense engineering."
"Okay. Then send me your resume. I'll take a look. Who knows? Maybe we have an opening at Jordan Technology."
"Outstanding, sir. I'll shoot that out to you right away."
Ethan reached out and patted Joshua on the side of the shoulder. "So you do remember me from our stint together at McGill Air Base?" Joshua's expression changed. "I remember that you set some flying records." Ethan's grin got bigger. "And I recall you're getting reprimanded on two occasions for taking joyrides with experimental aircraft without authorization." Ethan's smile faded.
"I can explain that, sir. And reprimands in your file about getting into a couple of fights."
"You know about that?"
"I make it a habit of knowing about the men under me." "The main thing I recall from your file, Ethan, is that you had difficulty taking orders when you disagreed with them."
Ethan's bravado disappeared. He looked down for an instant, but then looked up, straight into Joshua's eyes, and said, "With all due respect, sir, I admit my faults, all of them. But I also recall a story about a decorated flying ace doing surveillance over Iran's nuclear facilities. When the Iranian radar painted him, and enemy ground-to-air missiles were about to be launched right up his tail, command signaled him to abort. The flyer refused and kept his heading. He got the spy shots from the camera in that U-2X ultrasonic jet and returned to base without a scratch. Mission complete. That was one gutsy move that you did, sir, if I may say so. And that flight of yours over Iran is a legend among my flying buddies."
Joshua was suddenly taken aback by Ethan's account. But he also remembered what he learned at his briefing later at the Pentagon about that flight. Something he hadn't told anyone since. There was a reason he hadn't been blown right out of the sky. Somebody else had his back. In fact, a guy on the ground had sacrificed his life to ensure that didn't happen. He looked at Ethan. Young, talented, overly eager, way too cocky. But Joshua saw the potential, and the need for Ethan March to have somebody watch his back.
"Send me that resume," Joshua said. "But no promises." Then he shook Ethan's hand.
Cal was cutting through the big living room with its mammoth fieldstone fireplace and bear rug on the wall.
He glanced over just as Ethan was thanking Joshua for something, and the two were shaking hands. Cal stopped, struck by what he saw. His face tightened. When his father caught him out of the corner of his eye, Cal continued walking, through the room, out the front door, and down the front porch steps without stopping. Chapter 21. Joshua had a plan. He'd come up with it earlier on the porch, but kept it secret from everyone except Abby. His idea was to use the White House ceremony as an opportunity to slip the intelligence he'd received about an impending attack against the U.S. directly to the president. Joshua trusted Pat McHenry's intel sources, but just being at an event with the commander-in-chief wasn't enough. The real obstacles were the political realities he knew all too well. He had met with presidents before. Merely being honored with a Presidential Medal of Freedom wouldn't guarantee him private, confidential access to the most powerful man in the world. That much he knew. And there was another matter to consider. His founding of the Round Table itself. He had recently asked Abby to give him legal advice about any legal liability the group might have for its activities, and how close they were to the edge of danger. When he did, she just gave him one of those knowing looks. She'd already done her homework even before he'd asked, typical of Abby. But when she told her husband what she'd come up with, she adopted her serious lawyer posture. She cited the federal laws against seditious conspiracy, 18 United States Code Section 2384. Abby said that in the hands of a skillful, mean-spirited prosecutor, the meaning of the word force in that criminal law could actually be stretched to cover some of their plans to help protect the United States from foreign threats. Every member of the roundtable, especially Joshua, could be made to look like a wealthy criminal vigilante interfering with U.S. policy. In effect, running their own shadow government. It was a real risk. It didn't matter that they loved their country or believed the nation's leaders were failing its citizens and imperiling its safety from enemies foreign and domestic. The point remained, in the end, that their clandestine activities could land them all in jail. Maybe he was just being paranoid, but the facts were undeniable. Not long ago, Joshua had boldly defied a congressional subpoena in his effort to protect the proprietary design of his RTS anti-missile system to keep it from falling into the wrong hands. Then there was the contempt of court charge brought against him by a federal judge over the same issue, forcing him to go into hiding to avoid service of federal papers. Sure, things finally worked out and the charges were dropped, thanks to Abby's brilliant maneuvering. But he knew that some people in the White House were still trying to bring him down. What if his inclusion in the Medal of Freedom event was just an elaborate trap, to get him close enough so the feds could grab him on some charges he wasn't even aware of yet? And why did they instruct him that only one family member could accompany him to the ceremony? But his anxiety over all that seemed absurd. Why would the administration bestow a medal on someone just so they could arrest him? As the President of the United States addressed the small audience in the Rose Garden ceremony, Joshua was still wondering what had truly brought him to that place. He found himself in a row of 8 recipients, all standing behind President Virgil Corland. The President spoke from a podium, embossed with a familiar presidential seal, as press cameras whirred and fluttered. They had a great shot. The sprawling trees of the White House lawn framed the event, and far off in the background stood the white obelisk of the Washington Monument. Joshua looked out and located Abigail's warm, loving face. Joshua had not been prepared for how haggard the president looked. Tired eyes, pale, sunken skin. He realized why the administration had denied the cameras any close-ups. When it came time for Joshua to receive his medal, Corland said it was for recognition of his acts of bravery and civic duty in foiling a criminal plot at Grand Central Station, which not only threatened the life of his own son, Cal Jordan, but also posed a threat involving America's national security. Joshua thought it was strange to get a medal for that. He'd have walked through hell to save his own son. That's just what a father does. Most likely the president was ramping up for his re-election campaign and wanted to pander to voters who supported a strong national defense. But beyond that, Joshua got the feeling that he was there in this glittering rose garden ceremony because he was a chess piece in some kind of high-stakes political game. When it was over, the president went down the row of medal recipients and shook hands with each of them. Joshua noticed that he took the time to converse at length with every other medalist, but when he got to Joshua, he simply gave a quick shake, silently smiled, and then moved on without saying a word. When those on the dais dispersed, the president was quickly ushered by his staff and Secret Service detail back inside the White House. Joshua strode over to Abigail. Around his neck was the blue ribbon, and dangling from it was the white five-pointed star edged in gold, and laying against the background of a red pentagonal shield. Abigail reached out to touch the medal. Her smile was uncontainable, a gentle explosion of love, passion, and pride. She was about to say something when her eyes darted off to something behind Joshua. Before he could turn around, Joshua felt a hand on his arm. Two square-shouldered men in suits stared at him from behind sunglasses, with tiny electronic earbuds in their ears. "Mr. Jordan, please come with us." "What's this about?" Joshua asked. "You need to come now, Mr. Jordan." Abigail tried to keep things light. "I hope our Medal of Freedom winner here isn't in some hot water," she said with a halting attempt at a joke. The men didn't smile. "I'm not just his wife," Abigail said. "I'm also his lawyer." One of the men, ignoring her comment, said blandly, "Mrs. Jordan, you need to go back to the check-in tent beyond the West Wing. Wait there for more information." Joshua turned to Abigail. He looked her in the eye, but was staring right into her heart. "Don't worry, Abby. I'll be right back."
"You'd better be,"
Abigail snapped, loud enough for the two men in suits to hear. She kept her eyes on Joshua as he walked away, sandwiched between the two federal agents, until they disappeared in the milling crowd of smiling families and glad-handing politicians. Part 2. The Gods of Climate. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released data showing that from January to July, the average global temperature was 58.1 degrees. That was 1.22 degrees over the average from the 20th century, and the highest since 1880, when reliable records began. Although NOAA experts say global climate change isn't the only reason 2010 has been so hot, an El Niño event earlier in the year pushed temperatures up. David A. Farenthold, The Washington Post, August 14, 2010. At a gathering held during the climate summit of spiritual leaders from Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, and other traditions, I asked those in the audience to listen to the voice of the source as it spoke through the leaders assembled. They reinforced my view that these spiritual values, more than science and data, might be the basis for true human partnership among our leaders to achieve their ultimate objectives and avoid the cataclysms of melting polar ice, vanishing permafrost and glaciers. Wangari Maathai, 2004 recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, and the United Nations Messenger of Peace. More science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present ecological crisis until we find a new religion, or rethink our old one. Lynn White, U.S. Berkeley professor, from a 1967 article in Science. The filling of a spiritual vacuum by environmentalism creates an ever greater spiritual vacuum. The environmental religion based on climate change catastrophism is itself a catastrophe that we inflict upon ourselves at huge intellectual, moral, spiritual, and economic cost. Dr. Ian Plimer, award-winning professor in the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences, University of Adelaide, Australia. Chapter 22. The United Nations General Assembly, New York City. The UN had urged the Conference on Climate and Global Warming to hold its emergency session in the General Assembly chambers. The consensus was that a mind-bending climate disaster was fast approaching. What better place to discuss the future of planet Earth? No one was surprised that Dr. Robert Hamilton had not been invited to speak, not even at one of the smaller breakout sessions. Henry Smithson had used his influence to ensure that. But a few of his professional colleagues suggested that Hamilton's controversial theory should be heard, maybe at some future conference. Vice President Jessica Tullerud gave the opening address. She talked tough about the need for the community of nations to forge a courageous agreement to save our way of life, no matter what the political backlash. Several climatologists reported on their findings, and they all agreed, with only minor variations, that the recent planetary spike in temperatures presented a worst-case scenario. Earth was now in the early stages of catastrophic global warming as a result of human-created carbon dioxide emissions. Admittedly, it had happened faster than anyone had calculated, but the question now went far beyond abstract theory. It was a question of human survival. Some of the morning editions of the international news outlets had previewed what would be discussed at the conclave. The global conference sponsors had given them talking points, couching the issues in less than apocalyptic terms so that the general population wouldn't react with riots, but the message was dramatic enough to still ring like a fire bell. The press release read, "The nations of the Earth must construct a new way of solving climate problems as a global community, and it must be accomplished immediately. International climate law must be preeminent and binding on every human being, on every enterprise and business, on every nation. Global cooperation of all citizens of Earth will be our urgent mission. Our survival as a species depends on it." It was Romanian Ambassador Alexander Kolokhin's address that was to draw all the presentations together. The plan was for him to introduce Cesar Demas, the international financier and consultant to numerous heads of state, second richest man in the world. Demas was privately reputed to be the most powerful non-governmental person in the world. As it turned out, Kolokhin's remarks went beyond mere introduction. Kolokhin's warmly intelligent, winsome style was much different from that of the arrogantly brilliant and aggressive Cesar Demas. While Demas had changed the face of international politics by the sheer force of his personality and wealth, Kolokhin was more personal, more focused, and he had been, at least up to now, much more private. He had personally supported orphanages in Romania and other former Soviet bloc countries, and helped to start leper hospitals in Africa. But he ferociously avoided media interviews about his Good Samaritan gestures. Kolokhin was younger and enjoyed glamorous good looks, but like Cesar Demas, he was gifted with genius. With a Ph.D. in international finance from the London School of Economics and another degree from the Sorbonne in Paris, Kolokhin was a masterful communicator. Yet according to some pundits, he lacked the ability to go for the jugular. His friendly demeanor hinted that he lacked the killer instincts of a truly successful geopolitician. But things would change that day. Earlier, a limo had stopped near the North Plaza of the UN building. The door opened. When Alexander Kolokhin's ridiculously expensive custom-made Berluti wingtip shoes stepped out of the black sedan, more than 1,000 adoring fans were waiting to cheer him. No one knew how the climate activists had learned of his arrival. For them, he was the combination of a rock star and a latter-day Albert Schweitzer. The conference delegates had apparently never considered the possibility that Kolokhin had already gained a following among the ecology and global warming groups. Some conference leaders speculated that Kolokhin himself must have orchestrated the impressive love fest outside of the UN, but they couldn't prove it. Their underestimation of Kolokhin was even more surprising given his track record in promoting the credo. With his acumen in finance, he was a natural promoter of this new global currency. Even Jessica Tullerud, who sold the Corland administration and Congress on joining the new currency, had to admit that he had a certain administrative genius. In his address to the more than 1,800 delegates at the conference, scientists, politicians, writers, leaders of ecological NGOs and others, Kolokhin explained that he would be introducing that brilliant international treasure known as Cesar Demas, but added, "Rest assured, though, that I have not come to bury Cesar, but to praise him." After the warm laughter died down, It didn't take him long to bring the audience into the core of his sobering message. Borrowing from the poet T.S. Eliot, he warned, "If we do not today begin a revolutionary new approach to controlling the factors that are destroying our climate, then we will see the poet's horrifying vision of a world that ends not with a bang, but a whimper." The camera shutters from the media box fluttered like a million locusts as he spoke. He struck a good pose with his athletic physique, well-fitted Italian suit, and Hollywood face framed by boyishly tousled hair. Colokin previewed the plan that Damas would explain in his remarks. A global treaty giving extraordinary powers to an international climate control coalition, which would study all industrial sources of CO2 emissions and would police with an iron hand the activities of all companies, enterprises, and nations that in any way contributed to global warming. But there was one lingering question, a practical one. What could bring the community of nations to agree to this startling new approach when so many attempts at global warming conventions had failed in the past? Doubters pointed to the failed Kyoto protocols from decades before. What would motivate the citizens of the world to embrace this new way of thinking? Colokin had an answer. "The solution to this crisis is not just political," he said, "nor is it scientific. I believe, in the final analysis, the real remedy will elude us until we grasp the fact that this is ultimately a crisis of faith. We have in our midst today leaders from all the world's religions. In addition, there are representatives from the World Church Coalition, the Global Coalition of Religions, and many other ecumenical organizations. Most of the denominations of Christendom are represented here in this room. I have met privately with all of these leaders, and it is no accident that they all share a common element of faith, preservation of the earth. Christians believe in the redemptive act of Jesus who died for the whole world. We must finish the work of Jesus and redeem the climate. And doesn't Buddha himself say that nature shows us the way to Dharma? The Hindus know that Krishna was a lover of nature and nurtured it in his lifetime. And the Muslims understand the directive of the Quran, that Allah makes us guardians of the earth and loves not those who are wasteful of it. With a smile, Colokin began wrapping it up. It would seem that God himself is here today, and I think he's mad at our squandering and destruction of his majestic creation. He is sad that we have failed to solve this problem until now. But more than anything, I believe that God is urging us to unite. One family of people, one opportunity, one great mission. To save our one common earth, the only earth we shall ever have. The speech was electrifying. The delegates rose to their feet. Men and women from the four corners of the earth were for one brief moment united. Their applause thundered through the great chambers of the United Nations. Colokin waited until the very last hand had ceased clapping. Then he made the required introduction. "Now for a more important voice than mine. Cesar Demas has been called by the International Journal of News one of the most influential men of the century. That is an understatement. Cesar has unparalleled access to the most powerful leaders on the planet. His brilliant global negotiations have brought us to this point, this conference, this moment in history. If we succeed in saving the human race from the disastrous rise in global temperatures, we have one man to thank, our next speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Mr. Cesar Demas." As Demas strode confidently to the rostrum, he gave Colokin an uneasy smile and a quick handshake. As his introducer stepped away, Demas threw an almost imperceptible glance at Colokin's back, a look of camouflaged contempt for his scene-stealing speech. But Demas was ready to launch into his own explosive address. Regardless of his feelings about this Romanian upstart, Demas knew that the crowd had been ignited. That was good. Now all he had to do was to fan the flames. Chapter 23. Joshua Jordan hadn't expected his day would end this way. He sat forward in the chair, his hands cupped in his lap, waiting, anticipating, and tense. Finally, President Corland strolled into the Oval Office. His chief of staff, Hank Strand, was standing off to the side. Strand had greeted Joshua when the Secret Service first led him past the president's smiling appointment secretary, Judith, and then into the historic office. Joshua felt a flush of pride at being an American when he entered that alcove of power, and once again recognized the great seal embossed in the carpet and the famous resolute desk in front of the bay windows. A pale, tired-looking President Corland walked over to Joshua. He sidestepped the ornate oak coffee table that had been a gift from the President of Belarus. Corland reached out and shook Joshua's hand. Corland plunked down on the gold-brocaded couch, an arm's length from Joshua. The President began with startling informality. He asked about Joshua's wife and wanted to know if she had ever considered rejoining her previous Washington-based law firm, one of D.C.'s most prestigious. Joshua smiled. No, she has other pursuits and other clients now. But Joshua didn't say what he was actually thinking. No, Mr. President, keeping me out of trouble seems to be her full-time job lately. President Corland asked about his daughter, the soon-to-be West Point graduate, and then asked about Cal by name. How is he doing? Did he recover from his injuries in the Grand Central Station incident? Joshua appreciated that. Yes, thank goodness his injuries were minor, at least physically, which is amazing considering what could have happened. You were severely injured yourself, saving your son, said Corland. I read the rundown of what you went through. You're a tough customer. I had a lot of help that day. The president nodded. By help, you mean? FBI agent Gallagher, the NYPD, others. More nodding from the president. Then he added, and help from other places? Divine Providence, Mr. Jordan? It has shaped the history of this room we're sitting in. Do you believe in divine intervention? Your wife was known to be a woman of faith while she was still working in D.C. Hank Strand fidgeted in the corner. Corland noticed him. Hank, come over here and join us. Strand dutifully walked over and sat at the edge of the couch. The president continued. So, divine guidance, where do you stand on that? It was a surreal moment, nothing like what he had planned for, an almost out-of-body experience, especially for someone like Joshua. Even as a flyer and an engineering genius, he had been able to go through life with his feet firmly on the ground. I think the way things turned out at Grand Central Station that day, you might say it was a miracle, Mr. President. And the North Korean missile episode? That too. Joshua thought it eerie that the President of the United States would have put it that way. In his own private thoughts, not even shared with his wife, Joshua had replayed that day in Manhattan. The incoming nuclear missiles from the North Korean ship, the disabled East Coast anti-missile defenses, the scrambled jets that wouldn't have made it in time to intercept. Joshua, his team and their partners at the Pentagon had only one shot at two approaching missiles with the return-to-sender laser system. It hadn't even been fully tested at that point. He knew that day, in the hollow of his gut as he stood with his team, every muscle tensed and sweat beating on his back as they synchronized with the weapons guys on the USS Tiger Shark to launch the RTS armed defense missile in hopes of turning the North Korean nukes around, he knew the odds were against him, against catching both missiles perfectly and redirecting their guidance data. But that's what happened. And Joshua knew deep down that it wasn't his weapons design genius that had actually saved New York City. Not really. But something, or someone else had. Yes, Mr. President, Joshua finally said. That was a miracle, too. Corland's voice lowered a bit. You know, some of us, as we get older, occasionally get wiser. Even presidents sometimes wise up as time goes on. For instance, I fully realize now that God directs the destinies of nations. That much is certain. I also believe he can rescue us individually, save us, preserve us for himself, if we let him, of course. Redemption, It's an old-fashioned word. My grandmother was a Sunday school teacher. She talked about it all the time. The redemptive power of the cross. I think I finally come to understand what she was talking about. Then, without warning, Corland changed the subject. He said he wished he could have given Joshua more recognition in a more visible way for Joshua's RTS contribution in the North Korean nuke crisis back when it had happened the year before. Joshua remarked that no apology was needed, but he did sense an opening at that moment, a chance to share his pressing intel from Pat McHenry concerning the two coordinated nuclear attacks within the United States. Not a man to hesitate, Joshua said, "Mr. President, on that issue, regarding threats against the United States, sir, I have some urgent and disturbing information I need to share with you." Hank Strand's back straightened as he sat on the couch, one hand on each knee. Joshua kept talking. "I can't reveal my sources, but you must trust me when I say that they are highly credible." Corland didn't flinch. "Go on." "Mr. President, we have information that America is soon going to be under a coordinated nuclear attack, and it will come from within our own shores." Chapter 24. The commercial freighter, which was flying a Danish flag, was just 2 days away from the port of Philadelphia, the largest freshwater harbor in America. The captain, a Danish transplant from Russia, was in the wheelhouse, checking his logs, making sure the paperwork was in order. Bills of lading, commercial invoices. He couldn't afford any unusual inspections, not with the nightmare cargo he was freighting. He turned to his chief mate and remarked, "En klar dag for seilads." The sailor smiled back. "Yes, a fine, clear day for shipping." It would be an easy cruise up the Delaware River to the busy harbor. The channels were deep and easily navigable, ending in a substantially deep harbor, unlike Bridgeport, Connecticut, whose harbor was too shallow. A grounded ship would be a disaster for the mission, and the big open sea harbors of New York, Boston, and Norfolk had too much heightened security, too much military presence. Of course, taking a freighter as far inland as Philadelphia had its own risks. It was an audacious plan, but there was also a great payoff. It was close, so close, to the two targeted cities. The captain remained ignorant of the cargo's history to deliberately maintain plausible deniability. If he was captured by the Americans, he couldn't confess to what he didn't know, even under pressure, so the plotters kept each of the captains along the route in the dark about the details. The cargo had previously been split between two ships. The two terrible half-brothers had been spawned from two monstrous mothers. Now their containers lay side by side in the hold of the ship. Though they housed deadly potential, they still required final assembly and detonation. One container had come from a ship belonging to IRISL, the commercial line of the Republic of Iran. It had shipped out of the port of Bandar Abbas, bound for Karachi, Pakistan. There the name of the ship was changed, as well as its flag, to avoid tracking. But the cargo stayed aboard. From there it shipped out for Durban, South Africa. It was now called the Tigris, referring to the Middle Eastern River. But the ancient root of the word meant something else as well. It meant arrow. Meanwhile, the North Korean container started its journey in the bottom of a small commercial vessel named Daihong. When it arrived in Hong Kong, the ship's flag was changed to Indonesian colors. The ship's name was changed, too. Now Asian Flower was painted on the side of its prow. After a few weeks, the Tigris docked in Durban. A few days later, the Asian Flower joined it. The container from the Tigris was then unloaded and transferred to the cargo hold of the Asian Flower to join its evil twin. The Danish captain had boarded the ship in South Africa. Once again, the name and flag had been changed, this time to reflect a commercial shipping line from Denmark. His job was simple. Head straight to the port of Philadelphia. An encrypted satellite tracking device had been installed so that the group of plotters who remained behind in Kyrgyzstan could follow its passage across the sea. The plan was flawless. No one, none of the vessel watchdogs of the Lloyd's International Shipping Registry Office in England, nor U.S. Homeland Security, had picked up the flag and name changes or the notorious cargo, or the convergence of effort among North Korea, Iran, and Russia. The cargo continued to move to its destination without trouble. In any one of these harbors, Hong Kong, Bandar Abbas, Karachi, and Durban, bells might have rung, at least for a few of the veteran naval monitors.